Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and here at Bruegel, we are undergoing a research project on the future of work and inclusive growth in Europe. The project analyzes the impact of technology on the nature, quantity, and quality of work, welfare systems, and inclusive growth at large. The Sound of Economics is proud to contribute to the project with a space for discussion and analysis on this theme. And I'm happy to be accompanied today by Laura Nursky, who coordinates the project at Bruegel. Hi, Laura. How are you?
Hi, Giuseppe. I'm very well. How are you?
I'm very well, even though my voice is a little bit down. So cope with me as well as our listeners. In today's episode, we are going to speak about jobs quality. And joining us for this conversation is Janine Berg, who is senior economist at the International Labour Organization. And she's interested in inclusive labour markets, and she's a member of the Excellence Network for the Future of Work and Inclusive Economy for our Bruegel project. Hi, Janine. Happy to have you here at The Sound of Economics.
Hi, Giuseppe. Hi, Laura. Thank you so much for inviting me.
The issue of jobs quality is a particularly hot topic for policymakers, HR managers, and workers alike, especially in the context of the current transformation of the labor markets and the reflection about how this is going to play out in the future. Do you have a job that you secretly believe is pointless? On one hand, if so, you have what the late anthropologist David Graeber called a bullshit job. Graeber was a professor at the London School of Economics and a leader of the early Occupy Wall Street movement. And he argued that there are millions of people across the world, clerical workers, administrators, consultants, telemarketers, corporate lawyers, service personnel, and many others, who are toiling away in meaningless, unnecessary jobs, and they know it. On the other hand, they are not only pointless jobs, but they are also clearly bad quality jobs. And a return to unionization, even in countries such as the United States of America, is a signal of the need for a systemic approach towards the issue. One of the latest examples in the news was the recent and historical decision by the workers at the New York Amazon warehouse, who voted 55% in favor of joining the Amazon Labor Union back in April 2022. Laura and Janine, you've been both writing about jobs quality, and we are going to link up some of your papers in the show notes. Why does job quality matter?
Well, job quality matters first and foremost because of the effect it has on the well-being of the people in those jobs. So that's actually how it's defined in the first place. So job quality is defined as those elements of jobs that impact the well-being of employed persons. So that well-being includes both subjective well-being and objective well-being. So with subjective well-being, we mean the kind of well-being that you have to ask people, like how satisfied are you with your job? How engaged are you? How much meaning do you find in your job? For example, you refer to the meaningless types of jobs. Those are assessments made by the person in the job himself. But there's also an objective element to well-being, and that is a type of well-being that an external observer can measure. And then we talk about material welfare, physical health, mental health, like burnout. So all elements of jobs that impact those well-being outcomes are considered to be part of job quality. And there's by now like in a very extensive literature dating back at least 50 years that consistently finds these causal effects of elements of jobs on worker outcomes, ranging from working long hours or having low job control, impacting things like burnout, but also cardiovascular disease and even premature mortality. So first and foremost, job quality matters because of the impact it has on workers. And of course, you can imagine that if you have a workforce that is sick or unmotivated or unengaged, that this will have effects on productivity of firms as well.
Janine, what's your take on that?
Well, I very much agree with what Laura has said. Job quality is really important both for the individual, but also for firms, for enterprises, and also for society at large. So on the one hand, I mean, all of us, we spend most of our time at work. So it's really important that one enjoys one's job, because that has implications for our own mental health, our own well-being. But then, of course, there's secondary effects on how that person performs at the firm. So if a person isn't really happy in their job, if that job has a lot of work intensity, if the social environment isn't good and they don't have supportive colleagues or they don't have supportive management, if they don't have any autonomy or control over their working time, all these different dimensions are going to affect how they perform at the job. So on the one hand, it's going to affect whether they can be innovative in the workplace, which is obviously really important for economic growth, to have innovative workers that can lead to technological progress and other sorts of organizational progress that can improve output. But if they're not happy in the job, we know from the data that people quit. And when people quit, it's very costly for firms. It's costly for social security systems. It's costly for society. So we want to have healthy and supportive job quality and work relations that allow both the individual to prosper in the workplace, but also the enterprise to succeed because they have workers that are well adjusted and performing well.
Thank you. So why should job quality be a policy area? You point out why job quality matters, but then what exactly would be the kind of measures that policymakers could address this issue?
Right. So it should be a policy area because it's not enough to just have a lot of jobs. We want to make sure that the jobs are also good jobs. So it has to be something that is considered along with policies to increase the employment rate. Now, measuring job policy is much more difficult than measuring the rate of employment or the rate of unemployment because it's a multidimensional concept. So you have all these different dimensions. Europe has actually been a pioneer in the measurement of job quality through Eurofound's European Working Conditions Survey. So we have in Europe at least every 5 years indicators on the progression of job quality in the European workplace. But it's still nonetheless hard to capture. So some of the dimensions, such as the social environment, whether people have supportive management, whether they have supportive colleagues, and whether there's adverse social behavior, violence and harassment in the workplace, those are dimensions that they can be measured, but they're not as easy to measure as something like earnings or whether people work extended hours. Those are also other dimensions that are really important. There's also other issues such as autonomy. I mean, this really reflects people's own opinion about whether they have autonomy in the workplace. It's certainly important to measure it, but it's not as easy to measure as some of the other metrics. But that doesn't mean that just because something's difficult to do that we shouldn't be doing it. And I think what it really does clearly show with the data that's come out in Europe is that it allows one to see, what particular policies can then intervene to make the working environment more supportive for workers.
Good point. Good point.
If I can also pick on your question, Giuseppe, about why job quality should be a policy area, it's kind of the reverse question of why doesn't the market deliver good job quality by itself, right? I talk a lot to economists about this topic. It's not an inherently economic topic, right? So most of the research takes place in psychology and sociology. But when I talk to economists about job quality, I get two sort of questions. First, if everybody would be better off with better job quality, right? So workers would be better off, firms would be better off. Why doesn't this spontaneously happen in the market? That's the first question. And the second question I get a lot is, well, everybody has individual preferences. So what one person finds a good job, another might find a bad job. So I want to address those two questions because I know we also have an economic audience listening to this podcast. So first, if everybody would be better off, why don't firms raise job quality? Well, first of all, we describe a few reasons in the paper, but one I like to highlight a lot is this idea of the labor market as a tragedy of the commons, right? Everybody would be better off with a healthy workforce, like Janine said, one that is engaged, innovative, productive, but it's costly to some extent to raise job quality. So firms tend to focus on the short term, try to get the most out of the workforce in the short term and they don't internalize the effects that the quality of their work has on the long-term health of their workforce. So they are kind of depleting the labor market resources in that sense. So that's one reason, this tragedy of the commons. Another reason is that actually the volume of labor market transactions is quite low. So a market mechanism can only work if there's enough volume, enough transactions in a market. If you look at the number of labor market transactions that people make in their lifetime, the OECD has data on average job tenure, which ranges between 7 and 10 years on average across all of these countries. So that means that people in their lifetime hold on average between 4 and 6 jobs. So you cannot really speak of a large volume of transactions that can help the market function in that way. And then the second question about preferences. What I find a good job, you might find a bad job. There are several reasons why this is not true. There are objective elements of jobs that clearly have an impact on workers, regardless of your preferences, like working 12-hour shifts every night or having a very unpredictable schedule. That's bad for everybody. Also, these studies that I quoted on having low job control leading to premature death, that's bad for everybody. And then still, there might be some preferences between people on how you trade off certain dimensions of job quality. Like Janine said, it's a multidimensional concept, so we have to look at all of those dimensions together. And some people might trade off, for example, having lower job control in exchange for lower work intensity or having a lower wage in exchange for more holidays, for example. The problem is how we can separate these inherent preferences from these learned or socialized preferences and aspirations that really stem from the environment you grow up in and the chances that you get. The prejudice that people have. So if I'm a woman, I might be expected to take a part-time job and to care for my kids. So it's kind of hard to really disentangle these inherent preferences from these adapted preferences or learned preferences. So that's why we cannot just rely on people's preferences and say, well, this person chooses this bad job, it's their own problem. No, we have to set some minimum standards on those elements where we know that objectively all people suffer from this type of work.
Thank you, Laura. But coming back to the policy issue, because of course that's very important to understand the different approaches, and you rightly point out economists are not necessarily seeing the same thing that anthropologists and sociologists are seeing in this space, and it's important to somehow bring together those different perspectives and those different questions, especially as we were mentioning before, policies are discussed in order to address those issues. And Laura, in one of your papers, you've been also addressing specifically to make an example of how those policies could work. You made some examples about what the European Union could do in these regards. Of course, the European Union has a very specific institutional setup. It doesn't have as many competences in the field of the labor markets as the nation states. But however, I think that for the sake of understanding what can be done in this space is an interesting example, also because it's transnational. What we have been finding out on that?
You're very right that employment isn't one of the core competencies of the European Union, which makes it a bit difficult to talk about job quality. For employment rate, so job quantity, there is a bit more interest because of the clear economic effects. But job quality has been on the policy agenda for a long time in Europe. I think European policymakers do understand its importance for these reasons that we mentioned at the beginning of this episode. So for more than 20 years, European policymakers have been talking about better jobs. So ever since the Lisbon Strategy. Also in the European Pillar of Social Rights, job quality was put back on the agenda in line with its aspirations for building a fairer and more inclusive European Union. So member states have committed to setting some common minimum standards in the labor markets and welfare states, including in the domain of fair working conditions. Now, whenever economic crises have happened in these past 20 years, we do see policy attention shifting away from job quality back to job quantity. So whenever there's an economic crisis, think of the financial crisis or now the recovery after COVID, we see policymakers again putting more attention to raising the employment rate than to making sure we have good quality jobs. Now, whenever there is still some attention to job quality, it tends to be directed to dimensions of job quality, namely working conditions, meaning minimum wages and working time regulation. A lot of regulation in Europe has been on working time also, on having predictable work schedules, on having this parental leave directive. So a lot of it is on working time quality. Now also the initiative on minimum wages, European minimum wages, and safety. So occupational health and safety is also one area that sees a lot of regulation. So the areas of job quality that don't see any policy intervention are those two remaining dimensions, the social environment at work and the job content. So the actual tasks that people get, the challenges they get in the work, but also the level of autonomy and the level of skill development they experience in the job. So that's one area where we see a lacking policy initiatives, while we do know that these two areas are actually main drivers of these well-being outcomes of people.
And Janine, you, from your observatory at the ILO, you've been seeing these policies being implemented not just at the regional level, such as the European Union or their member states, but as well you have a global perspective on what can be done and what is being done across the board in different continents, in different contexts. What's your take on this policy making from that global perspective? Perhaps it could be interesting to hear.
Sure. In many ways, Europe, as I was saying before, is really at the forefront as far as measuring job quality, but also as far as implementing policies. Now, this isn't to say, though, that haven't been a lot of advances in other parts of the world, but most of those advances have been in the areas that Laura was talking about that are more easy to regulate, such as working time and minimum wages. And we shouldn't minimize these advances because this is actually incredibly important, especially for many parts of the world where people are still in work poverty, where they work, but their wages really aren't high enough to support themselves or their families. So we have seen in the past two decades really a resurgence of interest in minimum wage. Now it's something about over 90 countries have minimum wages. We've seen mixed increases in collective bargaining. It really depends on the parts of the world, but there's been some refound interest in collective bargaining, which is important for regulating either at the enterprise level or at the sectoral level, certain dimensions of job quality. We've seen across the board as well some reductions over time in working time, so excessively long hours, which is for more than 48 hours a week. You know, that's still something that we see in many parts of the world, but there has been regulatory improvements in many parts of the world. You can see this in China, for example, other parts of Asia. But we still have a lot of challenges. And the big challenge is that in many parts of the world, people work informally, their own account workers. So they're basically on the street, you know, hawking vegetables or doing that sort of work. And you can't regulate that because their own account, you know, they're not in an employment relationship. So there is a lot to do, but there certainly have been advances if you take a full perspective. But now, just getting back to the other dimensions that Laura was talking about, there are some dimensions of job quality that would be very difficult to regulate. You can't really regulate having a supportive manager or supportive colleagues. I mean, that's not something that's really very possible. What you can do, though, is have instances of workplace consultations. If you have some sort of workplace committees where people can, so a worker can go to a certain committee or a neutral body if they have some sort of dispute, those sort of mechanisms are really important. We also know that job security is really important for addressing job quality, because if a worker has a permanent employment contract, they're more likely to voice some problems at the workplace. If they're on temporary contracts, it's very difficult for them to speak out. They're worried about having their contract renewed. So there is certainly this relationship between precarity and job quality that comes from this lack of voice. So basically, the more security, the more voice workers have at the workplace, the better they are able to negotiate for more supportive work environment, but also more autonomy, more discretion in the work that they do, but also maybe, let's say, in their working hours as well.
You mentioned an important aspect, which I was about to ask both of you, which is workers' participation in all this and how this could be a very important element or a pillar in order to advance in the policy discussions as well. And we know, I mean, you mentioned before, we know that not necessarily this is welcomed from the company's perspectives. I mean, the example in which I opened this episode was about Amazon and this historical decision at the New York warehouse about unionizing. And we know, there is a lot of reporting about how workers of this specific company have been discouraged. And that's just an example. It's not to particularly target that specific company, but that people are discouraged from being unionized and trying to organize in order to participate in the workplace to advance the quality of their jobs. So I think this is a central piece in this conversation. How can we achieve more workers' involvement? How can we try to design workers' involvement within the jobs organization itself? I don't know if Laura would like to take on that, or if Janine would like to have a go on this question.
Okay, I guess I can jump in. So that's absolutely fundamental. I wouldn't say that all employers are against unionization or collective bargaining or even a voice at the workplace. I think there's definitely some good practice examples from Germany, from the Nordic countries, of very collaborative social engagement and social dialogue at the workplace that has proven to be successful. So, I think there is perhaps less resistance than one thinks. But that said, it's really important to have the regulations in place that support freedom of association and collective bargaining. And so we see some difficulties, for example, with the debates now about digital labor platforms. These workers have been classified as independent contractors by the platforms, which then precludes them from organizing and having a union. So right there, you see a situation where you have a new technology, a new kind of way of working, some problems in terms of job quality, long hours, physical risks at the workplace, lack of autonomy, lack of a boss to go to if you have a problem, and yet they don't have the right to unionize. So it's really important that all workers have that right. One of the fundamental labor conventions is on freedom of association, and the other one is on collective bargaining. And so this is something that, regardless of your employment status, you should have that right. And that's something that national governments and regional bodies should be supporting as much as possible, so that right can be in place. Because then when you have that, it's much easier to negotiate some of the dimensions of job quality at the enterprise level, or even at the sectoral level. But if you know, especially at the enterprise level, some of these issues really are specific to an enterprise. And so if you don't have that sort of representation at the firm, then it's very difficult to regulate. So you really need that. We have a paper that we recently finished with Laura and also with two other colleagues, David Spencer and Francis Green, looking at the industrial relations systems and job quality and the introduction of technology. And so for this paper, we used data on robotics. So it's just one dimension of technology. But we found that when robots were introduced, and this is in Europe, it had the effect of lowering dimensions on skills and discretion at the workplace. It lowered working time quality, and it increased the degree of work intensity. So for this, we actually used the indicators from the European Working Conditions Survey. But what was really interesting in the paper, so perhaps this wasn't that surprising, but what was interesting was that in those workplaces where there were higher degrees of collective bargaining levels, if there was that at the country level, then it meant that actually that those dimensions, while still negative, were mitigated. So the effects were not as negative in those working environments where you had actually this collective negotiation.
Yeah, Laura, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on what Janine was saying about how the effects of these technologies on job quality can be mediated by these factors such as collective bargaining or unionization. The thing is that technology doesn't have any predetermined effect on job quality. It's just a tool that we design and then implement in a workplace. And depending on how we do that, the effects can be positive or negative. I just want to give a few examples. For example, the introduction of the conveyor belt in the second industrial revolution, right? That led to a lot of job simplification. So a lot of lower autonomy, less opportunity for developing skills, right? People were put at a conveyor belt, repeating the same kind of task over and over again. So allowing to specialize and raising productivity. but lowering the variety of tasks that people were doing, having a lot of repetitive work, low autonomy, low skill development, right? But then if you look at the third industrial revolution, the introduction of ICT, of computers, those technologies didn't seem to have that de-skilling effect. Those have seemed to be more complementing, especially high-skilled labor. So people in high-skilled jobs tended to benefit from having computers. So they were learning new skills from this technology and increasing their productivity as well. So technology doesn't have any predetermined effect on job quality. It depends on how we design it and how we implement it. So when we design technology, this is also one element when worker or employee participation helps to make sure we have better outcomes of new technologies, because employees are the ones who understand the production process best, right? They do it every day. So when we are designing a technology meant to support this production process, they are the ones who have all the tacit knowledge about this production process. So if we involve them in the design of the technology, that makes the technology work better, right? So that makes the output or the quality of the technology better. And that also makes it easier to accept this new technology in the workplace, because workers then experience that this technology makes their job better, easier, lighter, more challenging, more interesting. So that makes it also easier to accept this new technology and to overcome this resistance to change that companies often complain about when they're introducing new technologies. So indeed, this involving employees, especially in the design of technology, is something that really comes out of the paper that Janine just mentioned.
So the last reflection that you were just making, I think you're positioning yourself a little bit in this big debate about automation, about whether automation is going to doom everyone or is going to be the solution for every single problem. I think that you are pretty much providing with data and clear analysis and evidence that it's not just about technology, it's about how you implement it and for what kind of purposes and in which kind of ways you implement this in the workplace. Am I correct? I mean, this is the way, the direction of speed of your analysis so far, right?
Absolutely. And I think this is such an interesting research area that we are looking into now, because economic theory, the most recent economic theoretical models about technology and work, they classify technology either as replacing labor or augmenting labor. And then they can have very nice models, you know, that can have very clear-cut theoretical results. But in practice, this distinction is not so easy at all. Automating one person's job might be managing another person's job. For example, if I'm a planner in a company and you automate away my job, so you have a planning algorithm or a scheduling algorithm, you automate away my job, so that's labor replacing, but then you are managing other people's jobs, right? So then you might be putting a lot of pressure on those people who are now being scheduled by an algorithm. Like Janine said, you no longer have a person to call to say like, hey, this schedule doesn't really work for me because my kid is sick, or I have to switch a shift, or I have to take care of my parents, or your shifts might become much more unpredictable because the algorithm might be able to adjust in real time to fluctuating demands in the environment. Oh, we expect a lot of people coming in today because it's sunny. Let's add some more people to this shift. So the algorithm can also make the predictability of the work less. Now, again, this is just how you design it, right? You can put constraints on an algorithm and say, don't change the shifts less than 3 days or 5 days or 1 week in advance. This is just a choice that you can make. And the point is, you have to ask people. You have to ask, like, how comfortable are you with having 3 days, 5 days, 2 weeks notice for changes in your shifts? And then you can program that into the technology. And the thing is that here I'm going to get very far out of the economic domain, but this depends a lot on the power and the status that people have in organizations. And that's why this unionization is also so important. I've seen a few studies where new technologies were introduced to people with high status in organizations. For example, anesthetists, so people who do anesthesia in surgery. So they are very high status doctors in hospitals, and they were getting Google glasses in the surgery room so they could get all the information they need, because it's a job that's very intense in the moment. So they have to look at a lot of parameters. They have to monitor the oxygen that's coming out of the mouth. So there's this meter, and then all the figures, all the numbers are on a screen to the left, but then they also have to look at the patient and see, look at the color of their skin and look if their chest is moving. So they have to watch a lot of information at once in different spaces. So they get these Google glasses where all this information is brought right into their eyesight. So that really supports and enhances their work. So it makes it easier for them to see all this information and then to make a decision like, is this person still safe in this surgery or not? So far, so good. This is not a de-skilling technology. This is actually a supporting technology. It's helping them. But then they followed up and they asked these people, how could we make this technology work even better for you? So there were 40 anesthetists in this study, and half of them said, I want to see more information. I want to swipe through the information. I want to get auditive information. So they just wanted to get more information. Only 2 out of the 40 said that they wanted decision support, meaning that the information would then be put into an algorithm and the algorithm would tell them, now this patient is in danger or now it is not. They didn't want this decision support because they wanted to keep themselves.
They wanted to take the decision. They want to keep control.
Well, yes, they wanted to keep control because they care about the patient, but also they know that that's what makes them valuable to the hospital, is their specialized knowledge in making these decisions. The point I wanted to make is that these anesthetists get asked about the design of the technology. We don't ask warehouse workers how their scheduling algorithm can work better for them. And that's why we need this right for association or this collective bargaining, so we can balance again these power imbalances in organizations.
Great. We are going soon towards the end of these episodes, but we cannot close without a reaction from Janine to this last part of our conversation regarding the use of technology. As you were mentioning, you've been writing the paper together with your colleague on that. What else would you like to add before we close this conversation?
I mean, I absolutely agree with everything that Laura is saying, and I think her example is really perfect. It's really about, you know, the more that you can involve the worker in the decisions about how technology is integrated into the firm, not only will this improve the job quality for that specific worker, but ultimately it's going to improve labor relations at the firm. It's going to improve that worker's well-being. It's likely to improve and lead to more innovation. I mean, we don't want a world of work where nobody's taking decisions and everything's being done by an algorithm and we think everything's fine, because there's a lot of unintended consequences, as they say in the technology world, from technology that we're not aware of that could occur if we take out humans. So maybe the short run benefits in terms of cost might be better, but in the medium or long term, it could be really devastating. So it's really important to keep the humans in the world of work, to have that dialogue, to have that constant feedback, to as much as possible integrate systems of participatory design, where you have the design of the technology, the feedback on the implementation, so that you can have a better world of work.
Thank you. And unfortunately, this is all the time we have for this episode, but we will keep the conversation alive within the research project at Bruegel on the future of work and inclusive growth in Europe. And The Sound of Economics will keep following the project, and there will be more episodes dedicated to the theme to come. Thanks a lot, Janine, for joining us from Geneva. And thanks a lot, Laura, for accompanying me as usual with those explorations in the world of the future of work. You will find in the show notes more resources about the topic, the papers that we mentioned. And as usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. Thanks a lot for joining The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you, Janine.
Thank you.